On the 17th day of August, 1786, in a backwoods Tennessee cabin located at the mouth of the Limestone River, where it pours into the Nolichucky, Davy Crockett was born. Those were exciting times when boys and girls grew up real fast. Davy was only 8 years old when his father gave him a long rifle and set him to hunting meat for the family. He got to know the woods so well, and all the creatures in them, that before he was many years older, the grown-up woodsman used to say, "That lad was cradled in a snapping turtle shell, and the cradle had a pair of elk horns over the top, with an alligator skin over the horns, and a wildcat skin for a pillar." He became such a legend, even while he was alive. It's hard to say what was true and what was false in the stories about Davy Crockett. But I was married to him, and I knew him. And here's the way my Davy used to tell it.
When I was 12 years old, my daddy, who was a poor man even for those times, bound me out to a German farmer from Virginia. In case you don't know what bound me out means, why, he sort of rented me to this farmer to help drive some cattle back to Virginia. I didn't like the idea much, but that farmer kept close watch on me during the day and slept right next to me at night, so I couldn't get away. When we got to his farm in Virginia, after walking 400 miles behind those cattle, the farmer gave me $6 and told me I had to do some more work around the farm. Well, I was a woods boy. That farm life was just too settled for me. So the first time a train of wagons came past the farm, heading for Tennessee, I went with it. When I got back home, my daddy told me he was in debt to a neighbor and asked me to work out the debt for him. I did, and then I worked out another debt he owed to another neighbor. After that, I was on my own and free to work for myself. Of course, it wasn't all working. We had shooting matches with beeves and turkeys for prizes and cabin raisings, where everybody pitched in and helped a neighbor build his cabin, and then there was the dancing.
I can tell you there was some mighty jumping and squalling when the working stopped and the dancing began. There was Scottish reels and Irish reels and Negro songs and play party songs, and the dancing lasted all night long. Oh, it was great to be alive and to be young in those days. We spread Indian bran on the ground and we danced barefoot with the light of the moon and some pine torches. It was real romantic. In fact, I met Davy Crockett at one of these dances, and before the night was through, we were engaged to be married.
That was Saturday, and the following Thursday, we stood up together and we got married. My Polly was good at near everything a woman could do. We rented a little farm, and I farmed it till after our boys, John and William, were born. When they got to growing up, I said to Polly, "This country's getting too crowded. Hardly a day goes by but what we see somebody. We gotta move."
"All right, Davy. Anything you say."
"I want my boys to grow up in new country and learn to hunt."
"Now, Davy, isn't that one word for the boys and two for you?"
"Well, I would like to hunt myself."
I know, Davy. I knew when I married you, you weren't cut out to be a farmer. Well, I guess we best be going."
Soon as spring came, we packed our household gear on a couple of well-grown colts, and with Polly and the two boys on our old riding horse, and me and the dogs walking, we set out for the duck and elk country.
We camped along the trail, and the boys helped hunt meat for the pot. They kept right on hunting, too, when we got to a little clearing Davy bought at the head of Mulberry Fork. We got there just in time for spring planting, so between that and putting up our cabin, we didn't have much time to hunt for food. By wintertime, when all our crops were in, we had enough coon skins to barter for all the store-bought provisions we could use. There was jerked bear meat hanging from the cabin rafters, wild honey to go on our corn pone, and plenty of warm fox furs for caps, and deer skin for leggings, and more coon skins for coats and bed covers at night.
We sure lived good, though it was pretty much of a sameness. About the only excitement we had was the hurricane that took the roof off the cabin and knocked down the clay chimney. Before the next winter set in, we'd moved into our new cabin down near the border of the Mississippi Territory. That was real hunting country. Few people and lots of game. Bears, panthers so bold they'd walk right into a cabin. More wildcats and deer than you could shake a stick at. And small game everywhere. Of course, there was Injuns, too. And about that time, they began to get a little nasty. The year was 1812, and we were at war with the British. So a Shawnee chief named Tecumseh decided that that was a pretty good time to get up a big army of Indians and wipe out the Americans. They were mostly Creeks, and they were mostly good fighters, too. And they kept us humping, I can tell you. After Tecumseh got killed, a half-breed named Weathersfoot took over as leader, and he was a slick one. It was him led the Creeks against Fort Mims in southern Alabama and killed every white man, woman, and child in the settlement. A wounded Negro woman managed to escape and carry word of the massacre to another fort 15 miles away. When the word reached Tennessee and the Corps went out for volunteers, I figured I had to go.
I was afraid to have Davy go. But he explained to me that if we didn't whip the Indians in Alabama, they'd soon be whipping us in Tennessee. He had 1,300 men in his little army, and supplies never did catch up with him. Between hunger and General Jackson, I guess that was the sorriest war ever fought. Davy had enlisted for only 60 days, so after he'd ambushed the Creeks at Fort Talladega, where they were fixing to massacre about 200 friendly Cherokees, he decided to come home for a fresh horse and a change of clothes.
It was a lot more than 60 days since we'd left, so a good many of the other men decided to go with me. Well, General Jackson, he didn't see it quite that way. In fact, you might say he didn't see it that way at all. He said we couldn't go. Anyway, we went. We came back like we said we would, but when we said we were going, we went. That was us volunteers. Now, the drafted militia, they didn't have the choice that we had. But they sometimes went without saying anything. Like the time the Creeks caught us when we were crossing the Tallapoosa River. We were split up, part of us on one bank, part of us on the other, and a whole lot of us right in the river when the Indians attacked from both sides. We just kept shooting till the Indians ran, so it wound up as pretty much of a draw. My horse got crippled chasing Indians, so since General Jackson had a little errand he wanted run up in Tennessee, I headed for home again. I rejoined the army after that, scouting and fighting. But I was sure glad when that 1812 war was over and I could go home to Polly and the kids.
We had a daughter, Polly, by then, besides our boys, John and William. And it wasn't long after that that Davy decided to move his family to a new country. It was autumn when he started out alone to find a likely spot to settle us. He reckoned he'd be gone for a week or two. But the weeks dragged into months, and there was no word from Davy. And then one day some trappers came, and they told us they had heard that Davy Crockett was dead. I wouldn't believe it. I knew he would come back. The snows of winter were melting when Davy came limping up our road, pale and thin, and he told us what had happened to him. First his horse had run away. Then he took sick so bad he couldn't even walk. Some Indians had found him and carried him to a cabin, where after a lot of nursing, he finally got well enough to walk home. We looked at him. We were convinced he was sure enough alive. It was long about this time that we discovered that respectability had sneaked up on Davy, and he was a man of property. We had several horses, a pack of hunting hounds, and a clutter of household gear that filled the cabin until there wasn't room for even broad-minded thinking. And as if that wasn't trial enough, the settlers in our area organized a regiment of militia and elected Davy colonel. Then, just a few months later, he was elected local magistrate as well. And that was a pretty hard business for him, because Davy could just barely write his name. But he started studying and practicing handwriting, and it wasn't long until almost everybody could read what he wrote.
Of course, I didn't neglect my hunting entirely, and a lot of wild stories were told about that. Before long, some friend, or maybe it was an enemy, put my name up for the state legislature while I was off in North Carolina selling some cattle. Folks kept urging me to really make a run at the office, so I agreed to try. When the other candidates and I'd go to a gathering of people, the other fellas would start yammering at the folks soon as they got there and kept it up all day. When they quit, and the audience was all tuckered out, I'd get up and tell a story or two and let them go. The people were so grateful for my short-windedness, they forgot what the other fellas said, and they elected me. And that's how Davy Crockett first got to the Tennessee State Legislature. I might have been better off to lose. While I was away from home, attending a meeting, a fire wiped out everything I owned. Actually, that fire was a sort of blessing in disguise, freeing us from the property that had us trapped in a country that was getting too much filled up with settlers. And we sure got away from them on our next move, which was to a land called the Shakes in western Tennessee, the scene of one of the greatest earthquakes in the known history of the world. It chewed up the scenery and spit it out in every which way, and it didn't stop with one shake either. The main shake was in 1811. That one was felt as far north as Canada and as far east as Boston. 11 years later, in 1822, when I was planting corn, it shook hard enough to knock my coonskin cap off my head. It was mighty scary. If I just had the sense to stay in the wilderness, we could have lived a happy, uneventful life for the rest of our days. Trouble was, two or three times a year, I'd have to ride out to the little settlement of Jackson to sell my furs and buy supplies. I'd meet people there, and we'd start swapping lies, and I guess because I was the biggest liar there, they decided to run me for Congress. It happened this way. The congressman from the district was in Jackson this one time, and sort of looking down his elegant nose at all us backwoodsmen. It kind of rubbed me the wrong way, so when he says, I suppose you people down in the cane breaks have plenty of bear steaks in winter, I admitted it. He sort of sneered and asked, do you enjoy them? Well, I told him, salt them with a hailstorm, pepper them with buckshot, and broil them with a flash of lightning, and they make pretty good eating. That pleased the local man, but the congressman sure didn't like it.
Those local darn fools, they liked it so much they made Davy candidate for Congress. And coming as it did at a time when fur prices were down and our growing family's expenses up, Davy made the run. It was a fool thing to do, and he paid the fool's price. He won. Him, Davy Crockett. Half horse, half alligator, and a little touched with snapping turtle. A man who could wade the Mississippi, leap the Ohio, ride a streak of lightning, slip down a honey locust without a scratch, whip his weight in wildcats, and hug a bear too close for his comfort. This man was gone to Congress, where he could be cut to pieces with words. He fought for the poor people of our district in Congress, trying to get them cheap land, and he was whipped. He fought for the Indians, trying to get President Jackson to stand by the treaty he'd personally signed with them after the Creek War, and he was massacred. Davy was sort of an underdog's underdog, and at the end of that term, he was back in the Shakes, farming and hunting. He made a lot of personal friends in Washington, but they just seemed to forget it when it came time for a roll call vote.
It was along about this time that some of those Eastern fellas began to write books and stage plays and things about me. Least folks said they were about me. I couldn't recognize anything in any of them that had happened to me, but it sure stirred up the people. When I took a trip around the country, going to Baltimore and Philadelphia and Boston and New York to get a look at the people back there, they all came out in crowds to look at me. And if I hadn't been so bashful and them so polite, I guess we'd have had the doggonest staring contest this country ever saw. Matter of fact, neither side believed what they were looking at. The upshot of it was, they told tall stories about me, and I went home and wrote a book about them and the awful, soul-cramping cities they lived in. Then I ran for Congress again. It was a case of me and my friends against General, then President, Jackson, and my enemies. And this time, General Jackson had the last word. I lost, only by a little, but I lost, and that ended me in politics. It also started me to looking for a new place to settle outside Tennessee. I gave it a lot of thought and then decided, since Trouble is my middle name and Texas is in the middle of trouble, I ought to feel right at home in Texas. So I went.
All our boys were grown, or nearly grown, full able to take care of me and our younger children, so there really wasn't anything to stop us. In November 1835, we started out. We tarried a little in Arkansas, where Davy was introduced to bowie knives. And although we didn't really see it ourselves, we were told by a man who could have been very reliable that when Arkansas grasshoppers settled down on a farm, they'd eat the crops, the buildings, the farmer's team, and then sit around and pitch horseshoes to see who got the house. Now, that might have been an exaggeration, but it wasn't the kind of a chance we wanted to take, so we moved on to Texas.
In fact, I spent a couple of months exploring the Red River country, and that was the richest country I ever saw. Mill streams, clear water, fine timber, and plenty of game. Even buffaloes. I sure planned to go back there after the trouble was settled. But first things first. I got together about 16 or 17 Tennessee men and headed for Nacogdoches. On the way, we passed through the little post of San Augustine and took the oath of allegiance to the Republic of Texas. The day was January 5th, 1836. We went on to Nacogdoches and then to Washington on the Brazos, looking for Sam Houston, who'd served with me in the Creek War. He was the commander of the Texas forces, but he was in Goliad then, so I missed him. And early in February, me and my Tennessee mounted volunteers headed toward Behar, where rumor said they were expecting a spot of trouble. Behar was the short name for San Antonio de Behar. Some called it San Antone. Anyway, a great Mexican army was supposed to be headed that way, with only about a company of Texans there to stop them. So we headed out on a wild, beautiful ride to join the Texans. When we got to Behar, we found a little over 100 men there. They were fixing to fort up in the old church they called the Alamo. It was a good defensive position with only one weakness. It needed at least 1,000 men to man it proper, and at our greatest strength, we had 164. And our command was divided. James Bowie was hauling one way, and William Travis was pulling the other. Still, while we were waiting for the Mexican army to come to us, we had some high old times. Fiddling, singing, swapping stories, it was better than a picnic. Right up until the time Santa Anna came marching up with his 5,000 men and horses and cannon by the score. Those numbers sort of took some of the fun out of our picnic. I'll say this, though. There wasn't a man inside the Alamo who suddenly remembered that he had important business someplace else. They were stickers from Stickersville, all volunteers, and like myself, most of them just looking for a place to settle where they had room to move around and breathe. Yes, sir, they'd come to fight, and they intended to stay and do just that. Travis summed it up in his letter addressed to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world when he said, "I shall never surrender or retreat. Victory or death." I offered to try to get through to Goliad and get some help, but Travis decided I could do more good at the Alamo and sent another man. He got through and got back, but he didn't bring us any help. It's the 12th day of the siege now. We're completely surrounded. Our food and ammunition are running low. And the Mexican cannon is breaching our walls. There's nothing for us to do but fight until the last man is dead. The Mexican bugles are playing the Degüello, their call for no quarter. And they're about to charge.
Here they come! Man the walls, boys, and make every shot count. They may whip us, but they'll always remember the Alamo.
Davy was right. Santa Anna remembered the Alamo. So did Texas and the Texans. They were shouting, "Remember the Alamo!" when they smashed Santa Anna at San Jacinto. And what of Davy? Davy and every other bold spirit in the Alamo had fought to their last breath. And in the end, found their last new home in Texas.